John, I think that we're going to be able to move on now to a discussion, as far as you'd like to take it, of your general service career. Yeah. From really, as we have covered in our earlier interview, your first lieutenancy, and we're now going to come perhaps to your second first lieutenancy. Can you just give me a date first?
Yes, I think for a bit.
Would it have been 1947?
No, it was after that.
48.
I think 48. Yes, I'm sorry, I can't remember precisely.
That's all right.
And the brief period I spent in the navigation training ship was marvellous because my captain was a navigation expert and he put me on course with the strike command exam. But for general service duties, I will say I only just got by. But next appointment, first attempt, was to an anti-submarine frigate at Portland, which is the anti-submarine training base. And this was marvellous because this was fleet training, although all our ships were of the training squadron. Because not only involved in anti-submarine training of individual officers and sailors, but when the fleet wanted a lot of extra escorts off the mint. And that was once again a tolerant captain who was very curious to know what flying pilots knew or what they didn't know. And I helped him in this respect, so to help me. But when I was only with him for quite a short time, probably not as much as 6 months, was then replaced by a charming man who had been a bit of war. And he was getting back into the swing of things. What I liked about him...
And his name?
Was Philip Boulnois. B-O-U-L-N-O-I-S. There's some other person of that name who's much more distinguished than any of us. And he was, in fact, a Channel Islander. And as you know, Portland was only 57 and a half... miles from the Channel Islands, so we paid one or two visits there. Now he is particularly good. I won't say because he was not married, but he enjoyed a bachelor livelihood, and if he wanted to go away for the weekend, he used to turn the ship over to me. And on several occasions, I had to take the ship to sea for training, and this was marvelous. Because you can do jobs quite well when your captain's breathing down your neck. But if you're really on your own, you are on your own. And I passed my destroyer scout in seven operations and in gunnery operations in that squadron. And it's exactly in what I wanted because it was intensive. No day was sort of wasted. And sure enough, I had a brief period ashore, which was nothing to do with my naval training, but I was a very good cricketer. And I knew I was good, but I didn't think particularly this was going to help my career. I was wrong. Because Admiral Troubridge, who'd been a flag officer in the Hero, he got in, and he was president of the Royal Naval Cricket Club, he said, "You've got a chap here who's not being used." So I was appointed, no doubt, to help train the Royal Marines in navigation, there's all those at Portsmouth, where I just bought a house, and played cricket for the Navy and the Combined Services, which is very high level stuff. But by this time it was 1950, and I did that for 2 years. And then I trained the Royal Marines during this time. The commandant of the school made it clear staff meetings that I should be normally relieved for cricketing duties. And it was absolutely beautiful. Because I really have two test sides. Because in this is National Service, because in the Combined Services side, except for me and perhaps one an army officer or two, they're all National Servicemen. And I got to know them very well, and they've always been, when I see them again, they'll come and sit and talk to me.
Now, I did ask you this before when we were not recording, but I think that Trevor Bailey played for Combined Services.
Did you ever but I never seemed to have played with him. I think I came after him, actually.
You did?
I think I came after him, actually. But my team was made up of Brown Coast, particularly. It was from Middlesex, Ross from Middlesex, Parks of Somerset, and one or two others. I could remember if I tried. Well, now who are national servicemen. And it was a great pleasure to play with them. Brown Coast and I viewed them as slips. And a good sleep slips because I could reach in all directions with both hands. And he went on, of course, as a Captain England.
How many matches did you play a year?
For the combined services, I would say three. The counties that gave us a fixture, not all of them would do it, but Worcester was one. Warwick was another.
And there was a third.
There was a third. Somerset or Kent or Hampshire. Of course, they're right on the spot. In fact, they played against the South African Dawn side at the ground, the Portsmouth ground at Hampshire. So that was my cricket thing. I didn't like to be labelled a cricketer, but I did have that. I did have that label.
Were you good enough to play professional first-class cricket?
I think I was relatively at the time. Yes, left-arm leg spinner. We're worth a guinea a minute to any side.
Yes,
but I didn't have ambitions that way.
You didn't. No. Well, that was my next question, really, because I wondered whether a life as a what age would you have been at this time, John? You would have been
very easy. If it was 47, I was 27.
27. So perhaps coming towards the end of, you'd only had 5 or 6 years as a professional cricketer, I think,
yes.
If you'd made the change.
Yes.
Yes.
I was only, as a schoolboy, I was offered we lived in Surrey. They picked me up very quickly. So I was in the schoolboy side, that's 1939, God bless us all. I play in a famous match which was called the Lord's Schools v. the Rest. And then from that, the side was picked to play against the army. And more latterly in my life, it was against the combined services.
And how did, apart from the Apple Trowbridge connection, how did cricket enhance your naval career, which I think you suggested it did?
Well, certainly, Trowbridge, to come to Lord and say, is it working out all right? I don't know what he meant, but I guess thanks to you, sir. they had a carrier in Malta, of course. We went Maltese, and if I get a year out, and I will say, I don't know why, so I was 47. I went out to them. Malta in 47, or was it 48? I'm sorry. And we had the second Admiral was very, very keen.
Well, don't worry, it's...
But he made sure that there was value in being an educator, career-wise. And I'm just saying, look, it was marvellous fun, so I played cricket all over the Mediterranean and in the Far East. And it was marvellous. I was in Ceylon. I know this is a sideline, but it does mean quite a lot. In Ceylon, they had we were training the Ceylon Indian Pakistan Navy, and included in the training was cricket matches. So I played against Indians, Pakistanis, and Ceylon people. And of course, they were all terribly keen to defeat us. So I call my side the England side. And I've got a hat to prove, if you want to see it. But that's what I do with cricket. And whenever I went, I played against Sierra Leone. I bet you haven't been treated in Sierra Leone.
No, I haven't.
Well, 3 times Sierra Leone, see? And that's when I first called our side the England side.
And they would have legitimately been described as the West Africans.
The West, I dare say, if they thought of it, you see.
Yes.
There was one up on that respect. And it was absolutely marvellous. Many years later, I'd gone into general service and I was commander of the naval base in Singapore. I went there in 62, so quite a lot has happened. And the Australians were coming through and they said, would we give them a game? I was captain of the combined services side.
In
62? We were in Singapore.
Yes.
You see? And the Australians were coming through on their way to England. I remember the Admiral sending for me and saying, what's all this about? And I said, well, it's an opportunity not to be missed. Not only to see how good we are, but also to see the Australian cricket. And he came and watched. And fortunately, we made it a thrilling game, absolutely. Thrilling, you know, 2 or 3 runs in it, and last over. And when I was in the naval base, I was responsible for some of the entertaining. And of course, Australians are marvellous people to entertain, because the slightest thing they got latched onto it. The wicketkeeper was a famous man called Wally Grouch, who lost all his teeth playing cricket. At the end of all this, Tom of the voice, he said, you know, the Christian name very quickly. John, he said, if you come to Australia, you'll never have to buy yourself a drink. I've never been. And he meant it with such enthusiasm. So that's cricket, you see.
Well, before we return back to your naval career, just quickly on that cricket, on that final, I think in 1962, would that side have still... I'm thinking of trying to name some names that people today would recognise. Would Richie Beno have been in that side? Would Bill Laurie? Would Bobby Simpson?
Bobby Simpson, yes. Bill Laurie, yes. Now, was...
Or had Richie Beno
retired?
The problem
about Richie Beno is that I met him in another match, but it wasn't a test side. And I can't remember. I can remember the South Africans in this country, but I played against them. And McGlue in it, and McLean, and that was... They'd been to England before, I went out to Singapore. But that was very much part of my career structure, to go to this executive job in Singapore. And of course it was a very big job. We were just building up the fleet in the Far East at the time, very strongly. In fact, half the home fleet came out at that time rather, because of the Indonesian uprising, as we like to call it, which is an Indonesian just over the horizon. We built a big fleet for that, and eventually we took back the places. I'm trying to think of the other island we took belonged to us. And that was, most of it fell on me. The ships arrived, and never been out of England before.
Well, we can come back to that.
But the central part of my career, and shortly after that, I got to the message.
What happened at the end of your second first lieutenancy?
Well, that was very interesting. It's a very good ideal ship to be in, because there the ship was training. They were training on very modern operational anti-submarine equipment. We were very busy. We went to sea every day, including Saturdays. Normally, we'd probably anchor out for the night and carry on. It was very intense and very, very satisfying. You felt that you were learning something and doing something. And that was in the Oakham Castle, which was a castle class fleet, which had just done war service, only just, a bit late coming in. And the captain, I told you, Philip Wilmer, if he wanted to go over the weekend, he went to the weekend. And I often took trips to see myself. in absolute confidence, and hugely helped by the other officers in the ship.
So where did you go after that ship, John?
I went to HMS Mayhem, which was the headquarters ship of the Amphibious Warfare Squadron. And I was appointed in command of it because the Captain AW, which was his official title, was still in Malta. And I'm therefore down as the captain of the ship for the Fleet Review of 1953. However, correctly, I think, because the squadron, the amphibious squadron of these great big LSTs and LCTs, was sent back to the review. So Captain AW thought, well, he ought to be there as well. So he came back and he stepped aboard the Mayhem a day or two before the fleet review. But they hadn't changed the name of the commanding officer. And then straight from the review, which was 1953, we went straight back to the Mediterranean. So I was first lieutenant of the leader, and I had wonderful opportunities to take trip to see his practice. But it was a complicated squadron. We had Mountain Batten breathing down our necks. So we knew we had to perform well. And we got very good at it. We did amphibious, we taught the Greeks amphibious operations. We taught the French amphibious operations. And we taught ourselves amphibious operations, all in the Mediterranean. And we took our landing craft to a lot of very strange places. We were always the headquarters ship and stayed out, of course. It was a marvelous experience of amphibious operations.
And so you were a first lieutenant again?
I was first lieutenant, yes. But first lieutenants of leaders were very much sought after job. It was supposed to be, and as it was in my case, it was a passage to promotion. And that was pretty good. But I had to get there for something, presented for something. I heard the flag lieutenant say, "Cricketer." So I got hold of him later and said, "Never again, son." And I, the cricketer. and we were quite good friends. That was the Honourable. Sorry. No, no.
Don't worry. Now, you mentioned something there. You said Mountbatten was quite good. I've heard very mixed reports about Mountbatten as a.
Well, several things. I think he was marvellous commander, really, didn't he? I won't say he was the greatest seaman or the greatest naval officer, but an extremely good commander-in-chief. I obviously picked out things that I remember. He ran the whole of Malta, really. His area of command included Cyprus and the Middle East, where when I landed my seaplane there, and that came back to trial, sorry, but we happened to have to go there as well for the amphibious operation. We were fired at by the Jews, which I thought was really good. We also had to bring back his polo ponies, because he had been presented by some sheikh, you see, and you can't refuse it. And our squadron collected everything. And I was talking to one of the CEOs, the one I was having once yesterday, I told him Sunday. And he said, yes, they had done it and brought these polo ponies back to Malta.
And did you see them playing at all, or ever?
Yes, I went to watch them play. I won't say I was a polo enthusiast, but there was an R in. A Royal Marine Polo Club. And they generally played all the polo in Malta. I used to go and watch. So I think he helped me. There was a sequel to all this when I got to the Admiralty. Well, I'll just go on. You can see where it fits in. And this is in a book, by the way, because I was asked to write.
Just give the name of the book, John, would you?
It's called, come on, Sal. Lords and Commons Cricket. Lords and Commons Cricket. I haven't got a copy yet. I have 30 copies, and I'm afraid to get something. Lords and Commons Cricket. And I had hardly arrived in there, this is me writing, when I sat down in the instrument field, and it spoke and said, "Secretary here, the Second Sea Lord wishes to see you." When he wishes to see you, it means at once, if not sooner. He's on the next floor up. And I said in my book, as a sort of touch, in Queen Anne's Mansions, which is where the personal apartment is, the more important you are, the higher up is your desk. I started on the ground floor. And I went into the presence. And he said, sir, Lords and Commons are playing the American Embassy at South London Ground, and the Parliamentary Secretary, actually, he wasn't, he was Naval Secretary, a civilian, of course, wants me to play. I must think of his name, he's a very well known cricketer and politician. We'll come back to him. A very good friend. So off I went to play against the American Embassy. But my interview with the Second Sea was that the Naval Secretary wished me to play. And my crest fell slightly. And I realised that both he and I knew that I could be easily spared for my duties. And the publisher of the book really latched onto this. He said that it was a marvellous lie. And I said, well, it was true, actually. And it was a very important desk job. So I wrote in this complete article, which was called A Guest Player. And against the American Embassy. And I embellished this a little bit. I'm sorry I haven't got a copy here. Because not only would I know all the American Civil War, American independence battles, but they've gone out of my head. Let's call it Lexington. Lexington told me that we would retrieve our position. They were battling. And what's more, I was going to fire the first shot. Now, you may not know it, but if you've read about the American War, you know the key to these two of them was who fired the first shot. And he was entranced by the fact that I remembered it. And I said, well, I didn't actually, but it sounded good. I was to fire the first shot. In other words, I opened the building. And described, it wasn't terribly funny, the Americans are all determined not to let the ball bounce, you see, because they were
baseball players.
Baseball players. And what's more, drama was about to happen. Because the second or third batsman, whatever it was, but it was something important, having failed to hit the ball, threw his bat behind him and set off in the direction of first base, and in brackets, come a point. But it felled our wicketkeeper, a minister no less. Blood was spilt. I put all this in, and it all back to Ewing, if his name means anything to you. Ewing, great people at our time. And this was all true. And blood was spilt. And the grass had to be watered to make the blood. And large as likely, I said, I can't remember. I mean, I was a fellow. I don't remember the name of the veteran, except he was black. He clung on to that for a moment, and put it in the book. I'm sorry, I haven't got a comment. But that was a moment, you see, when, if not my career, but certainly my life was so enhanced by cricket.
By playing cricket.
I came down here and played for the Lords and Commons once or twice again, because Peter lives in West Leamington. Very well known town with the Conservative Party, Brooke. Of course, I played for him down here for the Lords in Coburn. And there's all a sprinkling of MPs and things. So it enhanced my life enormously. I dare say it enhanced me. So they say, confirm my name. In that capacity.
Well, shall we take a break now and return to your naval career and your dealings, if any, with Mountbatten? Shall we? You happy with that?
Yes, but unfortunately, my dealings with Mountbatten were slight. Fortunately, his flag lieutenant, who I knew well, kept me in Mountbatten's picture. We did have another incident. That's me and Mark Bellman. And he actually deigned to come and watch the cricket in Russia and water. And I probably used the word deigned to come. Yes. And the flag was saying, I'll soon put it out right.
Well, we'll take a break and right. And return after lunch.
Right.
John, we're able to resume, and you're out in the Mediterranean, it's 1950. Mountbatten, I think, is your CNC. Can you tell me anything about what it was like to serve under Mountbatten, who's probably one of the Navy's most famous 20th century officers?
Well, I'm saying broad terms, really conscious of the fact we were under a commander-in-chief of distinguished reputation. In my particular job, we were greatly helped because he had been seen of amphibious warfare. We were in the new, very newly formed amphibious warfare squadron, the only coordinated amphibious organization in any fleet at the time. He wanted, I think, to promote us, so we felt personally attached to him as well. And this was reflected in a number of ways, like he was very keen on polo, and we had some chances to collect some polo pellets for us, which fitted very nicely into landing craft. That's enough on that subject. And also, which is all well covered in the newspapers, I wish I had some of the cuttings, was a German circus which got stranded in Malta. And our squadron was told to get it back to Sicily, what we did, and lots of fascinating detail. And what you do with 22 horses. They were there in the last, and the tigers and other things, but we got them out of water to Sicily. Thanks mostly, so the CNC told us, because he came to address the whole squadron, to thank us, and I mean the sailors, for taking part in this operation and assured us he hadn't been to Evina, and he doubted whether he would have taken it on. She's very convincing, and as president of our Dumb Friends League, you can understand it. A marvellous thing which every sailor understood up to the hilt. We weren't conscious of him as being a great seaman in any way. The fleet did sail as a fleet. On two or three occasions, either going to the Western Mediterranean or the Eastern Mediterranean. I was a first lieutenant in a frigate and spent long hours on the bridge, particularly at night. But I don't think there was anything special about the way he handled the fleet that I would dare comment on. But the sailors liked him. And many a sailor over the years, one or two when I was still there, used to say they were friends of Lord Lewis, because they had some experience with him, either signalling on the bridge or even the side party on a visiting ship. And that sort of thing was the way he treated him.
I think you've suggested at some point that he was very good, you felt, with sailors, but lacked a certain understanding or rapport with his officers.
Would that be sad?
I think this is so, and I did in fact use his expression, his comment a long time ago. He was extremely vivid, the second, so he's out of his hands with incorrect expression, bypassing all their own obstacles quite happily. But with, shall we say, the senior, what I'll call senior officers, people who have been in disguise for 10 or 15 years, of that man who had served in cruises for 10 or 15 years off and on, is that he was aware that they were far better seamen than he was. And the qualifications for seamanship, I think he knew that he was lacking in them, and therefore he wasn't confident in their presence.